Good morning, Chair.
Good morning, Chair, CEO, Human Rights Commission.
CEO, can you unmute yourself?
Can you hear me now?
Good morning, Chairperson. Good morning, Honorable Members.
Morning, Chair.
Morning, Chairpersons.
Thank you very much. Good morning to the Chair and to your team. Can we start? We will be receiving the annual performance plan and the budget of the South African Human Rights Commission. We have gone through your presentations. They were submitted on time. So we would give you 40 minutes in order to make your presentations because we have already gone through it. Today is a very... Our program is highly packed, so we will give you 40 minutes in order to present, and then we will engage with the presentation. Over to you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and thank you for the indication of the time. We, the members of the South African Human Rights Commission, of course, are very pleased to appear before you and to get the opportunity to present our annual performance plan and our budget for 2021-2022. The delegation that I'm coming with should comprise of four commissioners. In addition to myself, who are Commissioners Gaum, Commissioner Nissen, Commissioner Malaji, and Commissioner Sibanyoni. As you have seen, we also have the Chief Executive Officer of the Commission, Advocate Tipanyane, and his team. One of them, Mr. Siasanga, will then do the presentation of the annual performance plan, and Advocate Tupanyana will then give the concluding remarks. Chairperson, just briefly, we are pleased that in spite of the challenges that have been posed by coronavirus and related lockdown, the Commission has been going on and doing its work. You may have probably seen on the media that we recently released the long-awaited report on the Vaal River pollution, and that's this actually actuated the Department of Human Settlements, Water and Sanitation to step up and promise more action to deal with the problem of water and sanitation and pollution. The Commission, on the other hand, has identified water and sanitation as a crisis nationally in the country. And therefore, special attention is being paid to the problem with a view to tackling it from a national point of view. We were to meet with the Interministerial Committee at some stage, but I think due to COVID-19, that has not yet happened. To deal with that. On the other hand, we have recently also taken decisions to litigate, and we have decided to litigate against one of the worst cases of the violation of the right to water and sanitation. We have also intervened in protest and played an important intervention and facilitative role as the Commission. And then, Chair will remember that we had also the issue of the refugees that were camped in the church in Cape Town. We spent a lot of hours dealing with that situation. It still is a problem that we are dealing with it, but we are dealing with that problem. We also have been dealing with protest actions, and our intervention has actually enabled to bring about peace and averted the usual destruction of property, injury to persons, or even losses of life. And last we were here, we spoke about Senegal. I'm pleased to report that we were able to calm the situation in Senegal, the Minister of Social Security, of State Security, was also worried, had also approached us, and we're pleased that we were able to deal with that situation. It is a situation that actually brought up a number of other issues that we are dealing with, issues of hate speech, stock theft, border control, respect for the human rights of farm dwellers and farmers and many others, our Free State officers dealing with that. We made, during the lockdown, we have made many interventions with government departments, COCTA, when it came to regulations, COVID-19 regulations. We have intervened with regard to the basic rights to education, and we've made quite an impact in that regard also. But what is good, Chairperson, is that we have been able to forge a very good working relationship with the Department of Basic Education. And we are slowly moving in the right direction also with the MECs of education. We also have intervened with DERCO on the cases of South Africans who found themselves stranded outside the country during the hard lockdown. And we are very grateful also to the cooperation that we got from the minister and the department in that situation. We've been involved in a number of webinars nationally as well as internationally. There has been quite an interest from national human rights institutions in the African continent to learn lessons from one another about how national human rights commissions are dealing with COVID-19 related issues. And I'm pleased to say that we're featured in many of those because there's an interest in knowing how the South African Human Rights Commission is dealing with the matter. Even last week, we had one involving the Zimbabwean Human Rights Commission, which they've asked us to come and deal with. We have continued with litigation, but excuse me, on a slower scale, except that ongoing cases are still going. We're waiting with very eagerly the case, the constitutional case of Kwelane, because it has an impact on a lot of other cases that we are dealing with. We have, due to COVID-19, had to expand our cooperation with civil society and also with community radio in order to deal with some of the issues that need to be dealt with, especially in remote areas. And as far as planning for this plan, we have been planning in the context of COVID-19, and it comes with a lot of uncertainty about what's going to happen in future. And so the plans are severely affected by that. Also, we use technology, which means therefore that our communication amongst ourselves has to be facilitated or even constrained by the technology that we use. We have considered different methods of doing our work, especially in respect of the community and public engagements, monitoring visits and inspections and investigations, public engagement methods saw us increasingly interacting through community media and radio. The commission has endeavored to have a closer working relationship with civil society, and in this regard, we have signed a number of memoranda of understanding. In all this, we have been constrained, of course, in terms of our capacity as commissioners, in the sense that we lost our deputy chairperson on the 10th of October last year. Then two commissioners then went away for a very long period on sick leave. One of them is not yet back. And then one commissioner's term came to an end in end of January. Although one of them has come back, we are significantly charged, challenged by the decrease in number, especially with regard to the issue of governance. Sometimes meetings have to be postponed because of the quorum, because the act fixes the number of commissioners to be present in there. So while we acknowledge that every effort is made to fill the existing vacancies, we just humbly appeal for the continuation of attention to it, because it has implications. We also are constrained, like many others, by the issue of inadequate resources. The situation has not changed with regard to our resources constraints. And then finally, Chairperson, our monitoring mandate is arguably the most important, and also it's the most adversely affected due to COVID and the lockdown that came, because of the need also to ensure the safety of staff and commissioners. But also the complex nature of monitoring and the various pre-interventions that we need to do, interventions during the investigations and even after that, it is quite complex and resources demanding. And sometimes we feel that it is very severely challenged, and that the odds exceed our institutional capacity to monitor properly. At the end, Chairperson, I just wish to thank you personally and to thank each and every member of the Portfolio Committee personally for the support that the Commission has received from the Portfolio Committee. Thank you very much. Mr. Siasanga will follow after me. Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. We shall proceed from here. Good morning, Honorable Committee members, Chairperson. I just need to quickly put back the screen of the presentation. Just bear with me in terms of my visual, as I am co-hosting and controlling the presentation at the same time. Thank you, Chair. I hope that is back on.
Yes, it is.
Yes.
Thank you, Chairperson. We shall then proceed from the context that has been provided by our Chairperson. We shall then just provide now highlights of our human rights priority areas as identified within the current 5-year strategy planning cycle of the Commission, which runs between the years 2020 to 2025. And some of the areas of priority that we've identified include pro-human rights budgeting, wherein we really would like to see pro-human rights budget spending patterns within the space of the state, as well as compliance with pro-human rights budget policy guidelines. This is what we intend to develop by the end of this 5-year planning cycle. We also have a focus on good governance, anti-corruption and human rights. As we will note, the situation of corruption in our country is quite challenging, and we would like to see good and clean governance in the public sector in this regard, but also ensure that there is a good governance and anti-corruption systems across all spheres of government. In the space of healthcare, with all the challenges experienced therein, the issue of universal access to healthcare is one thing that we'd like to promote, as well as improved provision of services and facilities and so on in the space of health. The areas of education, ensuring that there is universal access to basic education, as well as progressive access to higher education. We are concerned and would like
to see improvements in the area of safety and security in all schools, and including especially water and sanitation infrastructure. We hear of stories day in, day out around these kinds of challenges. Issues of social cohesion being promoted, as well as addressing unfair discrimination in schools. On human settlements, water and sanitation, ensuring that social justice is promoted, as well as reducing homelessness and illegal evictions, and ensuring equitable access to water and sanitation. And then the areas of land, food security, and environment, again, the issue of illegal evictions, as well as ensuring increased protection, promoting food security, as well as water resources management, and especially the challenges around climate change initiatives, ensuring that those are being implemented. And lastly, in terms of the areas of priority, is the national preventive mechanism under the optional protocol against torture, compliance with the optional protocol, as well as ensuring that the conditions are improved at all places of deprivation of liberty. We also then do give focus to broadly civil and political rights, ensuring the protection of all civil and political rights enshrined in the Constitution, and that would include some of the work that we've done recently that focuses on the protection of human rights defenders. The next slide actually lists some of the transversal issues or cross-cutting issues that we then give attention to within the context of all the above mentioned priority areas. We then want to give particular attention to issues of inequality, issues of the rights of children, issues of gender, the rights of persons with disability, older persons, migrants, and a focus on the role of business and human rights in ensuring promotion and protection of rights. Then the next section, we then talk to what is it that we then want to achieve out of those identified human rights priority areas. As the Commission broadly and in general, we have structured the section looking at our four programs as we are structured in the Commission, program one being our administration, and wherein we want to maintain and enhance the stability of the institution so that we have adequate capacity to deliver on these planned priorities. And in terms of program two, which is the promotion of human rights and linked with our promotional constitutional mandate, is really for us to be able to influence policies, legislation, and service delivery improvements that are from a pro-human rights perspective, as well as create awareness of human rights. Program three relates to our protection mandate, wherein we really seek to secure appropriate redress where human rights have been violated. And lastly, program four is on the monitoring mandate. And here we really seek to ensure that we accountability for human rights in the country is actually improved. Then just breaking down in terms of the different programs, when we look at administration and stabilizing the institution and ensuring capacity, what is it that we then focus on that we will do to try and realize this? A focus on good governance and leadership, ensuring that there are good governance practices within the institution so that the institution is well-led and well-managed. Issues of financial viability and sustainability in the context of shrinking budgets. This has become one of the priority issues to focus on for us as an institution. Human capital management, ensuring that we have adequate capacity, adequate skills as may be required to carry out and deliver relevantly on our mandate. The issue of impact monitoring and evaluation to be able to assess what impact we're having and where we can fill up performance gaps and ensure improvements so that we impactfully deliver on the mandate. And the issue of information and communications technology in the current stage and age, the issue of the fourth industrial revolution, we need to be able to ensure that we make use of technology to advance human rights. The next slide, two slides or so, they then reflect just a listing of our selected performance indicators and targets in relation to the administration program. I will not go through the list of the indicators. It's really just a list of indicators that then committee members can go through and scrutinize in order for us to achieve and realize the above mentioned. The second program is the promotion of human rights, wherein in order for us to influence policies, legislation, service delivery, and create awareness, some of the key things that we then focus on or do to realize this is strategic stakeholder interventions and engagements with various relevant stakeholders at certain levels in order to achieve this, whether it's for policy formulation, whether it's for legislative changes, and so on. Then we conduct a host of conferences, dialogues, and workshops in this regard as well with various stakeholders, whether it's strategic stakeholders or communities. We also do liaise a lot with the media and communications to ensure our visibility as an institution, but also to create awareness through various media, ensure that we increase issues of readership, viewership, and listenership. We also focus a lot on community empowerment and awareness through various programs and public outreach interventions and engagements. Again, a list of some of the performance indicators and targets in relation to the promotion mandate. You'll see in relation to some conferences, just to highlight the intended racial polarization conference that is to be hosted during the first quarter. We also look at the issues of the gender equality in terms of the Amman Declaration that was signed by the Commission back in 2012. And in the context of the current challenges around gender-based violence and so on, we felt it's necessary that we bring back and show implementation of those resolutions. The issues of functionality of equality courts in the realm and space of ensuring that we address the issues of inequality in the country. An action plan looking at COVID-19, the impact of COVID-19 on children through the form of a conference again. Just to mention some of those that we intend to focus on. We also, just to highlight that, held a conference on corruption in the last quarter of financial year, the ending financial year during March. And the focus going forward, starting from this financial year, will be then to implement the resolutions arising from that conference. We have received a lot of stakeholder interest in collaborating and participating with in this process, and to mention also that the conference was hosted jointly with the public protector. The slides, next two slides, I think, they also then just indicate some of the areas and issues we would like to zoom into and focus on in terms of our promotion program. So these are possible areas that we may then focus on. Some of them were already involved in this kind of work. For an example, submissions in terms of the Equality Act, the issue of corruption, as I have mentioned, and a few other issues and items here that were already either already involved in or planning to then take on. Both those slides then provide that kind of a list. Program three, protection of human rights, and our intended outcome here to provide appropriate redress where rights have been violated. We focus here on ensuring that we finalize and resolve the complaints that are lodged with the Commission on an ongoing basis. We focus on ensuring that our complaints management systems are effective and efficient. We continuously review these to ensure that we manage the complaints processes effectively. We then also do embark on proactive initiatives to ensure addressing the systemic human rights violations in order to prevent and avoid recurrence of violations in certain spaces and areas. An example, as highlighted and mentioned by the chair in the opening, in terms of the issues we dealt with in the Vaal River inquiry. We also then intend to be holding national inquiries. In this year, we will be looking at issues of access to healthcare, as well as the issue of social cohesion in schools. And lastly, the instituting a strategic impact litigation in identified and selected areas, a list of which is provided in the presentation below. Here, the slide lists again the performance indicators in relation to the protection program. And there is a list of some of the areas and issues that we would like to possibly look at in terms of litigation. Those are the two slides. And the final program is our monitoring program. In this program, the intention and aim of the commission is to improve accountability for human rights. And what we want to do here is to establish a comprehensive, or rather review, and ensure that we have a comprehensive human rights monitoring and assessment system. And through that system, in this financial year, the focus will be given to issues of children's rights monitoring. We are currently developing a mapping framework to understand what is going on in the space of children's rights and what monitoring mechanisms exist, so that we can then pick up on that. We also will be focusing on the monitoring of the vaccine rollout during these stages of COVID-19 and the rollout, ensuring that everyone, there is equitable access and that it reaches where it is supposed to reach. The issue of schools monitoring, we focused on whether it's in relation to issues of safety during the COVID-19 and the measures put in place to ensure that schooling is not adversely affected. Two, issues of infrastructure in schools, the challenges of water and sanitation in schools, the issues of violence in schools, and the like. Lastly, the focus will also be given to the national preventive mechanism in terms of the optional protocol against torture, wherein we look at, we monitor and visit places of deprivation of liberty, whether it's prisons, whether it's older persons' homes, homes for persons with disability, as also places that house children and the youth. Centers. I think we'll also be looking at psychiatric hospitals in this financial year. And then we also do conduct an assessment of the state of human rights, as well as compliance with certain legislative prescripts, including economic and social rights as provided for by our constitution. We do look at issues of equality in relation to the Equality Act and the state of rights in that regard. Civil and political rights, as well as promotion of access to information. And then we also do monitoring in relation to international and regional human rights obligations with respect to the various international conventions and instruments. And that covers then the monitoring program. We then do provide a list of the performance indicators in relation to this program. On that slide. And then, Chair, I'm just going to open up in terms of the budget overviews, and I will then invite the CEO to proceed with the budget section, and then also to get into our wrap-up and concluding remarks. He may then want to highlight and emphasize some of the areas that we have reflected above. Just in terms of our allocation for this financial year, we are receiving 195 million, which is then also augmented by interest income of 1 million rands, as well as a surplus rollover of 10 million, which then takes our total budget to 206 million. Let me then invite the CEO Chairperson to proceed from here. CEO.
Thank you.
Can you also deal with the issue of your slides?
Thank you, Chairperson. The issue of the slides, sorry, I missed that.
They are not moving, so we do not
move. Oh, Sia, can you please move the slides to slide? The budget slide?
I'm on the budget overview total allocation slide.
Okay.
Are we all there?
We No, we can't see it. We only see the chairperson's overview.
Oh no, the slides are moving on my side.
Chair, Wilma here.
Okay.
Okay, no. No, it's fine, Chair. I see that. I wanted him to move the slides on the screen because it wasn't moving. Thank you, Chair.
Okay.
I just wanted to know what slide are you on now?
That's slide 29. Okay. Chair, thank you. I got cut off a little bit.
Sorry, CEO. Are the slides back on properly now?
Yes, we can see slide 29.
All right, thank you. Sorry about that. It was moving on my side. I didn't realize.
Yes. My apologies, Chair. I also got cut off. Can I start first of all, Chair, by also welcoming our newly appointed CFO, Ms. Dikwa, who began this month in April. And also thank my colleagues as well for the presentation. So as the slide 29 shows, Chair, that is the total budget we have for this year, including the rollover, which we got from Treasury last year. So, Sia, can we move on to the next slide? And then, Chair, this slide is basically an attempt by the Commission to try and, reduce spending. And a number of things have been done in this regard in the past. We've frozen a couple of posts, but also re-looking into the organizational structure to see how we can make it a bit more efficient and lean. But also we have reduced our office space. We've currently moved into our new offices since last month. And we have reduced our office space from 7,000 square meters to about 2,500 square meters. And therefore, this gives us some savings. And we're busy now renovating offices. And I've been told that at least from this Friday, we should start getting our proper services like IT and so forth. So we're trying to stay within the budget despite the implications this has on all of us. So we are doing mindful, Chair, of the challenges the country is having around finances. Next slide, Sia. This is just the total breakdown, Chair, across the different cost centers in the commissions. Personnel costs do take a lot of money for us, but that is the breakdown, Chair. Sia, next slide. Again, this just gives you a proportional allocation of the budget across the line items, and you can see that we are spending about 66% of our budget on personnel costs, followed by issues around corporate services, office rental, and so forth. Next one. This again then just highlights across the different line items, what we are allocating for finance, human resources, office of the CEO and NPM, and also special projects of the commission. See ya, next slide. Now this allocation in terms of the work around the promotion of human rights. And again, the allocation for commissioners, the human rights officer, human rights advocacy, as well as the provinces. Next one, Sia. This also on the protection of human rights. As Sia says, there's a need also for us to do a bit more work around these issues in terms of the high impact litigation. And therefore, this is the allocation which we've given for the protection of human rights. This is our monitoring mandate. Again, we have given 8.6 million here. And as I was saying, Chair, we're also trying very hard to improve our monitoring mandate under section 184 of the Constitution. And we'll be focusing mainly on three issues this year, issues of health and education, as well as the NPM in this regard. But this mandate is also quite important to give us necessary intelligence around the work which we need to do. So, Chair, if I may then just add, according to what has been said earlier on by Sia, that we, following our conference in March this year, there's a lot of work which has to be done around issues of corruption and human rights in view of the impact this has on the realization of human rights. And one of the things we want to focus on is to look into the legal framework, you know, around the protection of whistleblowers. And then we'll be having a lot of dialogues around those issues to see, you know, how can we ensure that this regime is much better, because we do need whistleblowers to be protected in order to, you know, fight the war against corruption, which we really regard as tantamount to, you know, a serious violation of human rights. And then around issues of transversal issues, issues of children, we are about to sign a funding agreement with UNICEF on child rights for this year, which will then help us also to do a lot more work we've been doing around issues of children. And then one other thing I would like to mention is that, you know, following the incidents in Limpopo, where Lena, who was bullied, committed suicide, were planning a hearing on violence and bullying in schools in the province, and this will also then inform our other interventions as far as issues of violence in schools is concerned, as well as our work on broader education issues. And then, Chair, I also want to mention the fact that, you know, the NPM has done quite a lot of work over the past 3 years, and this is our last year in terms of the funding cycle which we've been given for the NPM. So we'll be engaging with Treasury to see exactly what is the way forward as far as these issues are concerned. But we're also engaging with other stakeholders as far as, you know, the future of this important work, which is basically based on the realization of the rights under Section 12 of our Constitution, the rights against torture, cruel, inhuman, and degrading punishment. And then the other challenge for us, Chair, is that how we'll survive the COVID-19 storm. It has really had a major impact on us since last year, March, where much of the time our offices were, you know, people working from home, commissioners and staff members, and we've been trying a lot to try and keep the organization afloat. And fortunately, we managed to get into these digital platforms, which then enable us to, you know, to be able to work from home, and that has managed to keep us going. So we'll need to see now going again forward, how do we, you know, do much better as far as, you know, the challenges around COVID-19. And of course, we are quite grateful that we're also allowed, even during the lockdown periods, that we could actually go around, you know, doing our work. Unfortunately, we lost one staff member due to COVID-19, and a few other staff members and some commissioners actually were affected by this. It continues to be a challenge, but we'll try and make sure that, you know, we find better ways of dealing with this. And then, of course, Sia has also mentioned the issues of inquiries which we are planning this year. One around issues of racism in schools as well, especially in private schools. That's something which we have to deal with. And of course, our whole monitoring, as Sia was saying, around issues of health, education, that will be going on. Then on the protection mandate, we've been battling to fill the post of the head of legal services. We've been trying to headhunt, but we're actually trying again to make sure that this unit helps us a lot in you know, advancing our work in the protection mandate through a high impact litigation. So we'll try again to find someone who can help us in this very important work, because the prevention of human rights it relies a lot on making sure that, you know, people do not take the violation of human rights as an easy thing to do. There must be a price to pay for those who violate human rights, and this mandate actually helps us in that regard. And then, Chair, with this short remark, then let me end here. Then we can then take questions from the members of the committee. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You are within your time. Thank you very much for that. Also, let me start on behalf of the committee to also pass our deepest condolences to the Human Rights Commission and to the family of the member you lost. May her soul rest in peace. Would also, in that vein, would also like to welcome the new CFO, Ms. Digwa, into the fold. We wish her all the best in her new employment. We are here to support her and the commission. I will note members who would want to ask questions and or also make comments. I have the following members: Honorable Nivo Trachan, Honorable Mola, Honorable Johannes Breitenbach, in that order. Honorable Nivo Trachan.
Sorry, Chair, the interpreter was just getting ready. Good morning to everybody. Thank you, Chair. And thank you to the Human Rights Commission for the presentation, and welcome to the new staff members, and condolences for the members who've passed away. Firstly, I would like to say I really appreciate the difficult role that the Human Rights Commission has to play during these difficult times of COVID and having to go out. So we really appreciate your work. I would like to understand, in relation to basic education, what exactly does the Human Rights Commission assist with, you know, other than, you know, the racism in private schools, or, but what are the other things that the Human Rights Commission assists with? The reason I ask is that I would like to know that, you know, if the commission has a chance, if they could visit farm schools. I took the opportunity to visit some farm schools, and in one of the schools, it's their grade R children, small little kids, and their classroom, the one wall is actually made out of a canvas. It's not a proper solid wall, so they are subject to the weather, and these are really small children. And especially now with winter time, I mean, it's not conducive for children to learn. So in these kind of situations where children are learning outside in the cold, you know, could the Human Rights Commission visit such schools? I would also like to request that the Human Rights Commission visit schools for deaf children. This is a very personal matter for me, because there are demands that obviously the requirements for using masks during COVID times, but the masks prevent, you know, as a deaf person, they prevent communication. And at the beginning, you know, this was very difficult because, you know, as a deaf person, you know, it was difficult for me to go out because it hampered my communication. So I'd rather stay at home because I knew I can't communicate if the masks are covering the faces. And the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, can that be monitored, and can we see the impact that the mask has on deaf children in the school environment, where it is compulsory for students and the teachers to wear masks? But children need to see the full face, the full facial expressions, to be able to communicate. And so the masks are a communication barrier. And yes, it's a necessity to use masks, but we need to weigh up, we need to weigh up that situation. And then the Disability Advisory Committee advises the commission in terms of human rights? How far are you with that? And also 2021-2022, the independent monitoring mechanism, is that in place yet, or has that target been removed? I would like to know how far you are with that. And yes, those are my questions. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mola.
Thank you very much, Chair. Let's welcome to the presentation from the Commission. I've got some few issues there, Chair, to raise. The chairperson speaks of the collaboration of the Human Rights Commission with the Department of Basic Education, particularly. In my knowledge, Chair, as well, is that part of the dominant factors that are causing protests across the country is what we call socio-economic rights, which are encapsulated particularly in Section 26 and Section 27 of the Constitution. Among those, Chair, is the rights to water and sanitation, human settlement. I just want to mention those who are dominant in the protests across the country. In this collaborative system they have established with the departments that are providing services to our people, have they been able to reach a cooperation agreement or collaboration with the Department of Water and Sanitation, Human Settlement, in terms of ensuring that the rights of our people are not transgressed by these institutions? I've mentioned 26 and 27 in the Bill of Rights. Part of what is a fact is that district municipalities are given the water services function. Have they been able to go to the ground, to those districts, to ensure that they monitor that these rights that encapsulated in the transgressed by the municipality? No, as within the available resources in this district, water settlements and sanitation is provided to our people without any prejudice. That's my first point, Chair. The second point, Chair, is that the president has proclaimed gender-based violence and femicide as a second pandemic in the country. And in my own legal knowledge is that basically GBV is a pure transgression of Section 10 and Section 11, the dignity and the right to life. But having been followed these, let me say, popular cases on GBV and femicide, I have not necessarily seen the role the commission has played in ensuring that the perpetrators that transgresses these two important rights are taken to book. Maybe let me make it this way, Chair, my question. What has been the role of the commission as it relates to what the president has proclaimed as a second pandemic, which is GBV and femicide? The third issue, Chair, that I would like to raise is that we have undertaken as the committee a process of filling vacancies in the commission. In line of us doing that, part of what was the dominant and widened concern about the commission is the issue of accessibility and the visibility. I heard they say, speaking about awareness campaigns or something of some sort. But the question that I would like to ask, Chair, because in my own view, if the commission is not accessible to the people, there is no way that we must continue having the commission as part of our Chapter 9. And for people to gain access to the commission, it must be visible for people to know that there is a watchdog of human rights in the country called the South African Human Rights Commission. So those two aspects speak on both accessibility and visibility. Have they allocated a budget in advancement of these two important aspects that I think are the core, will assist the core business of the commission? There's been an allocation towards the achievement of accessibility and visibility of the commission. Another issue, Chair, that I would like to check with the commission. They are speaking of the fourth industrial revolution as a future thing. If I recall properly, Chair, we have arrived in Parliament for the sixth administration in May 2019. And at our arrival, already in the country, there was a heated discussion on the fourth industrial revolution. Now, we are in 2021 now, but the commission reports to us as though that the fourth industrial revolution is a future concept. In my view, if the commission is able to advance the fourth industrial revolution within its operation, it can be able to assist in a way on the visibility and accessibility. So the question would be, what are the plans to move fast towards the fourth industrial revolution in terms of the operations of the commission? The last of which, Chair, we are speaking of COVID-19 regulations, the pandemic, blah, 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 at which a number of state institutions, government departments, and all arms of the state have directed funds towards COVID-19 related matters. But part of what is not in dispute is there is a justifiable transgression of people's rights, which comes in the form of the National Disaster Act. We have seen the tensions in the country when these regulations were introduced by President on the 26th of March 2020. Some were threatening to take government to court for transgressions of this and this, that it is collapsing business, blah, 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 blah. But in that too, Chair, we have not seen the watchdog of human rights playing a central role in ensuring that there is an awareness to our own people on the human rights transgression, that this is a justifiable transgression that is encapsulated in Section 36 of the Constitution, the Limitation Clause. Maybe, Chair, put it in a simple way. What has been the role of the Human Rights Commission as it relates to human rights transgression throughout the lockdown that has started on the 26th of March until today, Chair, the 14th of May 2021? Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable President Bach.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Good morning to everybody. My first question regards OPCAT. OPCAT was ratified in March 2019. The Human Rights Commission is the tasked with looking after our business with OPCAT and the National Preventative Mechanism. They received 1.68 million from Justice for this work in the last financial year. I'd like to know what the funding, what funding is in place for 21-22, and where will it be received from? What are the plans for that? And then an update on the work done in terms of the National Preventative Mechanism, please. The Human Rights Commission has told us, secondly, that they may not be able to meet their property obligations. That's somewhat concerning. What is the position? Are they going to be able to meet those requirements? And then, what steps have been taken within the Commission to mitigate the effects of COVID-19? I don't really glean that from this document. It must have an effect, and how are they planning to deal with that going forward? And then, the Human Rights Commission produced a report on pollution in the Vaal River, which was a very long document, an excellent document in my view, where they mentioned that Gauteng's most vital resource has been irreparably damaged. What is the follow-up on this issue? The Vaal River is, of course, very important to Gauteng, but also to the country. How are they following up on this? Are they monitoring it? What are the plans for that issue? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Breitenbach. A few questions on my side. The Chair raised the point that the IMC has not been able to meet with the Human Rights Commission because of COVID-19. But to the best of my knowledge, we do have other forms of meeting and communications, like this one, the Zoom meeting. Is that the justifiable reason why you were not able to meet with the IMC for such a long time to discuss a very important issue that the honorable members have talked to, the issue relating to water and sanitation? And if we could be updated on that so that we can be able to see how do we take it forward. You, in the document, you have also raised the point that you would not be able to meet the POPIA requirements. You might not be able to meet them. So what emergency measures are you putting in place to mitigate against that possible non-compliance with the POPIA Act? And then you also, how much savings have you made from changing offices in terms of rents and cents, from that 7,000 square meters to 2,500 square meters? How much did you save in terms of, or how much are you going to, or how much are you projecting to save in terms of rents and cents, and what will be the impact positively of that to your budget? Your targets are very broad. For instance, we've got broad targets of between 80% and 100% implementation, and you know that that is unacceptable to us. We want targets to meet the SMART principle. So next time you come and with very broad targets, we will be very, it will be difficult for us to approve your plans, because broad targets are not easy to properly monitor and oversight. So we would want targets that meet the SMART target principles, so that we can be able to do also on our side a proper oversight. There is also, I think the last one is the issue of your internal audit. You resolved last time to try and deal with your findings, to deal with the findings, to deal with 81% of your findings, but you've only been able to do 59% of your findings. which talks to the credibility of your own plans going forward. What plans are you going to put in place to ensure that the targets that you set for yourselves, you are able to meet them? Over to you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, honorable members. Let us try to respond to the questions raised. With regard to the question of what does the Commission assist with in so far as basic education is concerned, perhaps Commissioner Gam will tackle that question. With regard to the issue of the farm schools, may I simply say that in my opening address, I did indicate that monitoring is one of the most challenging, most important, but also most challenging mandate of the Commission, in the sense that it is resources intensive and we do not have sufficient resources. We do visit farm schools, but unfortunately we cannot visit all of them. We also do visit schools for people with disabilities. Unfortunately, due to resources constraints, we are not able to visit all of them. One of the things that I would like to highlight is that one of the reasons why we have now adopted one of the priorities as a human rights-based budgeting is the realization that actually government has got a constitutional obligation to also adopt policies that relate to human rights when they budget, because the amount of money that gets given arbitrarily is never sufficient for us to do all the things that the Commission is expected to do. We have complained about many things wrong with schools, with hospitals, and so on. We've had the issue of pit latrines. We've had the issue of farm schools and so on. But all these require resources. We have gone there. We've monitored, we've seen what they look like, we have tried to intervene. At some stage, we need to do litigation. Litigation costs a lot of money. We just did one case which cost us more than $1 million. So it's one of the violations that are continuing with regard to basic education, together with others like the ones I've just mentioned, of pit latrines, which we are still dealing with. But Commissioner Gam will deal with that. Unfortunately, Commissioner Malanji has a power cut and is unable to answer. But yes, there is monitoring of special schools for people with disabilities. And I've noted and I'll raise with him the issue of the masks and the problem that the masks cause, so that this can be given focus to. And then if I could continue to the questions from Honorable Ngola, for which I thank him. He asked the question whether we have reached collaboration with water and sanitation. Yes, there has been quite a lot of collaboration, of work, of engagement, let me say, rather than collaboration, with the Department of Water and Sanitation. The engagements have been at various levels, including with the minister, with especially the Deputy Minister, Matobo, in this regard. It was through them that the interministerial committee meeting was proposed and agreed to. And the chairperson has been asking, why is it just because of COVID-19? Part of it is COVID-19, but part of it is that, of course, we are told each time that the deputy president is not available and so on. And it hasn't moved beyond that. We have asked, we've been waiting, we've sent reminders. We need government also to play its own role, because we have raised this, we've told them that it is now, we told Minister Mahlobo that it's now a national crisis and it needs to be attended to as urgently as possible. I think the minister herself also is aware that, you know, there's a big problem with water and sanitation. But government also needs to do something. The interministerial committee needs to be convened by the deputy president, so that we can go and make presentations there and make recommendations, and then plans are adopted in that regard. So we have tried. I could say that perhaps there is room for us to try more, but it's something that we have been doing. Commissioner Mermia, especially towards the end of his term, spent a lot of time pushing this aspect. Question is, are we monitoring district municipalities? Yes, we are monitoring district municipalities. One of the district municipalities in the Eastern Cape is the one that I was referring to when I was saying that we are taking legal action against them. We monitor in the Free State, we monitor in Mpumalanga and in other places, where the situation is very, very bad with regard to water and sanitation. The next question was about the president having declared or proclaimed GBV as the second pandemic. I agree that it's an affront to the right to dignity and the right to life. The answer to the question raised as to the role of the South African Human Rights Commission is this, that, you know, Chapter 9 institutions, some of them have got specific mandates, and the gender issue is the mandate of the Commission for Gender Equality. And among ourselves as Chapter 9 institutions, noting the scarce resources that we have, we tend not to duplicate work. There are certain things that by some agreement are forwarded to the public protector, and she forwards things to us. We forward things to the IEC, they forward things to us. We forward things to the Commission for Gender Equality. So this is a case that is being dealt with by the Commission for Gender Equality, where we can intervene, as in the case of Caster Semenya. We have intervened and we are intervening. We are in the European Court to deal with the issues of gender, but mainly that is the mandate that is in the hands of the CGE. And with regards to the visibility of the Human Rights Commission, in our view and our assessment, the commission is quite visible. We will then have to look at the suggestion that it is not accessible. It hadn't come to our attention that it's not accessible. In fact, I think the CEO will confirm that we have dealt with actually a greater number of complaints than previously. The media is aware of us, will get interviewed on an ongoing basis, even in vernacular radios like you know, Xhosa speaking, Zulu speaking, Ndebele speaking, Swati speaking. We are all there, and these, some of them are regional radios, and we are visible to the communities there. There may, of course, be people who do not know about the commission, but I think the commission is doing its best to be vocal and visible. The issue of the fourth industrial revolution, may I leave it to the CEO? The issue of the government departments having diverted funds towards COVID-19, and then the results, the transgression of rights of individuals. Well, Honorable Ngola may have a point in this regard, simply because there have been debates and discussions within the Commission as to the extent to which rights have been violated and to the extent to which those violations are in transgression of Section 36 of the Constitution. It's something that is debatable. We in the Commission have seriously debated the ban on alcohol, the ban on cigarettes and what have you, but got to a particular conclusion about whether or not to take these matters forward. But departments such as social, PSD, COCTA and others know that where we found that there were violations, of course, we go to them, we write, and we have had many things changed because of our interventions there. My sense is that perhaps it's a matter of degree rather than whether the Commission is doing something and whether the Commission is visible. We could be visible with more resources if we can have. Commissioner Nissen and the CEO will deal with the issue of OPCAT and the steps to mitigate COVID-19. The Vaal River pollution matter, I think Honorable Breitenbach would remember that that Minister Sisulu immediately responded and promised action that she would be taking. The Gauteng Provincial Office is following up, is monitoring this and following up on it. It may be too soon to say, to make a call on it. But it is something that, yes, the Commission is monitoring. Chairperson, the issue of the IMC, we would be very pleased if we could get assistance in that regard, because we have asked and we have asked that we appear before the IMC. We were called to appear before the technical committee of the IMC and then promised that the actual meeting with the IMC would take place. How to unblock that, I do not know. I do not know. And then the CEO will deal with issues of space and how much savings, as well as the issue of POPIA. Finally, Chairperson, thank you very much for the point about the broadness of our targets. We note it, and we're certainly going to make sure that we revise our targets and that for the future we peg them accordingly. And then the internal audit, the CEO will answer. Thank you very much. Perhaps Commissioner Down could come in, followed by Commissioner Nissen, and then the CEO will finalize.
Yes, thank you very much, Chairperson of the Portfolio Committee and Chairperson of the South African Human Rights Commission. In response to Honorable Neuer Druchen's question about monitoring of schools, as the chair have indicated, we are indeed monitoring schools, including farm schools. We don't have the capacity to monitor all of these schools, but we do that to the extent that is possible. During COVID-19, Commissioner Nissen will tell you that we have formed a Section 11 committee for purposes of monitoring. And in that process, we involved civil society organizations who were not able to do work themselves, but under the auspices of that Section 11 committee. And we very specifically continued to monitor schools even during the entire period of COVID-19 and the lockdown and so forth. As far as the specific examples mentioned by Honorable Neuer Druchen are concerned of schools with inadequate infrastructure, I would ask her to please bring that to my attention. We have regular contact when she has issues that she wants to bring to the Human Rights Commission attention. So please, if she can do that, that is absolutely unacceptable in terms of the national norms and standards for school infrastructure. It is quite clear what measures need to be met by the department, and we are absolutely enforcing those infrastructure norms and standards from our side. So if the specific examples can be brought to my attention, then I can assure you that we will deal with those issues. Then as far as the visits to schools for children who are deaf is concerned, I will certainly also from the education focus area side liaise with Commissioner Malachi. We can bring these visits and we can look into this particular issue pertaining to the wearing of masks and make a determination as far as that is concerned and engage with the relevant education departments. Then on the matter of water and sanitation in the school context, the commission has done a lot of work already in this regard, engaging the National Department of Basic Education, but also engaging the MECs for education. There, according to the National Department, all schools in the country, and that is what they have been informed by the provinces, that all schools in the country do have at least a water tank and at least a temporary sanitation facilities that is adequate. We have found that that is actually not really the case. And somewhere there is a communication gap or the correct information is not provided to the National Department and the DG there. And therefore, I have engaged all the MECs for education in the provinces, asking them for specific data and details as far as water and sanitation is concerned. Unfortunately, I have to report to the portfolio committee that there are some of these MECs who are simply not responsive. Some of them have delayed the provision of that information drastically. And in other cases, in the case of two provinces, the Eastern Cape and the Free State, we simply did not receive a response. So the commission has therefore decided to subpoena those two MECs for that information. I'm also writing another letter today to all the MECs asking them for updated information in this regard. And the commission will have no choice but to subpoena MECs that do not respond this time around in time. The first request for this information has already been sent to MECs last year, August. And, you know, as I indicated, two of them haven't even responded up to this particular date. But we are determined to deal with this matter of water and sanitation at schools. All schools should at least have water tanks and should at least have temporary sanitation facilities, especially during the COVID period of time. There was also the question about protest action and municipalities. The commission has decided that we will now start focusing very specifically on municipalities that are dysfunctional, that are not providing the services required, and we will start intervening in these municipalities. We are already intervening in a specific municipality and taking the municipality to court due to its non-responsiveness and the fact that they are not dealing with basic service delivery issues. On the visibility issue, I think the CEO also have the specific statistics as to how visible the commission has become, and maybe he should provide that to us. Our visibility has increased quite substantially over the last couple of years. And just on the fourth industrial revolution issue, the CEO will deal with that, but from my side, the commission has adapted quite dramatically as far as that is concerned. we are having these kinds of virtual meetings with people, actually people around the world. I was involved in a conference with people from all over Africa not long ago. We are consulting with our lawyers pertaining to the Caster Semenya side case. Some of our lawyers who are pro bono and based in the UK, professors from Oxford and so on. So I think the commission has adapted quite dramatically as far as that is concerned. Even this national school moot court competition will this year be a virtual competition, and data will be made available to learners to ensure that they can participate. And I think the fact that we have also taken the step of decreasing our office space is a further indication of the fact that the Commission has immediately adapted to the new environment. But the CEO can also, deal with that matter more specifically. I remember I think it was last year or the year before, we already had a conference or a workshop on the fourth industrial revolution, its impact on human rights and on the Human Rights Commission as such. Then just from as far as the National Disaster Act is concerned, violations of rights and so on, as the chair pointed out, the commission has constantly asked ourselves the question whether regulations from government in this regard, whether these regulations were indeed reasonable and justifiable in terms of Section 36 of the Act. In some cases, whilst we were very specifically considering taking some of these regulations to court ourselves, other civil society institutions did that, so it was not necessary for us to do so. But specifically in relation to the matter of the opening of schools and schools staying open, the commission has intervened very specifically. In one case, we have differed with government quite substantially when the opening of schools was delayed, and we made our point quite clearly that in our view, it is not reasonable and justifiable under those circumstances to delay the opening of schools. We have engaged in this regard very strongly with the DBE, and interestingly enough, in most instances, we and DBE actually agreed that schools should be first to open and last to close. How much savings? I'll leave that matter to the CEO. It is CEO. It's quite clear from page 32 of our submission, the substantial saving that we are making. And I think, last of all, it is indeed, in my view, an example we are also setting for others, that we were willing to decrease our office space and to adjust as far as that is concerned in order to save money and to adapt to the COVID-19 situation. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Chair, I don't know if Commissioner Nissen is here, otherwise I can proceed. Hello. Okay, thank you, Chair. Can I then start with the issue of 4IR, that it has been mentioned that the Human Rights Commission did organize a conference last year, March, on 4IR and its impact on human rights together with the HSRC. And we have just published a book together with HSRC, which came 2 weeks ago, on how bodies like us could respond to the challenges of 4IR in terms of human rights. But also, as my commissioners have pointed out, we've also made adjustments as a commission as to how to use 4IR in order to effect our work. And therefore, when COVID-19 came, we then took a decision to make those changes last year, April, after the conference in March. So what we have done, for example, Chair, is that we've given all our staff members laptops and data to be able to work from home. most of our engagements are now through this digital platforms. If you recall last year, our 25th anniversary in October, as well as in December, where it was mainly digital, and therefore we're able to reach out to more people. In March this year, our conference on corruption and human rights, which included bodies like health, was 100% digital. So we're basically moving into that direction. Of course, our problems with this approach, Chair, is that, you know, some people will not be able to have access to this platforms due to issues of internet and data. And therefore, also thinking of pushing that, we must actually push hard to make internet a human right, access to internet a human right. And we raised these issues last year with government around issues of education, that, you know, the lack of internet, access to internet, was really creating inequalities in our countries between rich and poor learners. That's an issue which we still have to deal with as we go around issues of monitoring education in schools, because clearly, as COVID-19 continues, we'll have to rely more on these platforms and therefore a greater usage of OIR. We have an MOU with the HSRC to look into how we can further advance this work around FOIR, because that definitely is the future. So we can assure you that this will remain one of our major concerns. So even the reduction of the office space, was also take into account that where to a large extent, you know, will now allow our staff members and commissioners to be able to work from home and also in the office. And so in that regard, Chair, the reduction, the savings from our rental, I'm told it's about 7 million rand. We've reduced from 7,000 square meters to 2,005 square meters. We've largely made offices open plan so that people can just walk in and out. And of course, much of the savings will be much more realizable next year, because now we have to buy furniture and mix, and other necessary changes. But certainly it is a huge drop in that regard. And I think we must be commended. Despite, of course, all the pains of moving from offices to open plan, we'll need to address that as well in the commission as to how do we deal with this. And then on the issues which have also been raised, I've just mixed up my pages here. mixed up my pages. Let me try and remember what I was saying. Okay. Then on the issue of papaya, we have an arrangement with information regulator. We've actually moved in the same building with them, so that our neighbors, even in this new building. So we are meeting. We have signed an agreement on transition, and therefore we'll work hard to make sure that, you know, we as a commission, after the IR, the second body which leads, for example, as far as adhering to papaya. So we'll do our best to make sure that we do adhere to this, despite all the other challenges which we have. Then, as far as the audit matters are concerned, Chair, that still remains a concern. But we have a new audit committee, and we have a new CFO. And I don't want to make an excuse, Chair, that for the past 2 years we've been using a level 12. As an acting CFO, due to the problems we had with our previous CFO. Now at least we have gone back now to appoint a CA at level 14 who will help us to deal with these issues. And we do appreciate also the role which has been played by our acting CFO over the past 2 years, even at that level, just to hold the fort. So we're definitely looking to these issues as much as we can. And we promise we'll do much better. We've had meetings to make clear to colleagues that, you know, we need to get a clean audit, not just an unqualified audit, but a clean audit going forward. We'll see what we can do, Chair. Now, on the issues of visibility, Chair, again, you know, the issue is according to whose standards? I would like to believe that the Human Rights Commission over the past 3 years is one of the most visible Chapter 9 institutions. In terms of our media coverage, we're in the media almost every week. And last year, when we reported to Parliament, to the Portfolio Committee, our media coverage was worth over 400 million rands. This year, when we submit our reports, there might be a decline due to COVID-19, but it's still very, very high. We do acknowledge, Chair, however, that, you know, the reach to rural areas and you know, other marginalized areas is still a concern for us, which we have to address. And that's why, you know, for example, during COVID-19, we had these monitors who were working with Commissioner Nissen to try and go to other areas. But also we're signing MOUs with another organizations to work around, you know, the issue of, we call it the concept of community human rights defenders, to actually champion in communities people who can work with us in order to advance human rights. But also in terms of disability, Chair, we also had meetings this year with NASFAS around the whole issue of you know, access to funding at further education. And we've met with them twice now. They're asking us to assist them, you know, in dealing with their complaints, handling mechanisms. We also have a think tank on child rights, which includes many other organizations, you know, UNICEF, Social Development, Center for Child Rights Institution, Cape Town, Child Law Center, a whole lot of NGOs working around child rights issues. And of course, also our moot court, which applies in all schools in the public schools in this country, also shows you the kind of a footprint we are able to have. But of course, we always have to, you know, keep on improving on this. And I think maybe we need to, when we submit our report, our annual report, which should actually show in greater depth as to what we have done as far as you know, increasing our footprint and making sure we also reach out to rural areas. But certainly we use a lot of radio as well. Our provincial managers and our provincial staff members go out. You know, as I was saying, we'll be having this hearing in Limpopo in that school. Again, that's another example of us reaching out to rural and marginalized areas. But I think we'll have to maybe, as I was saying, structure how our coverage goes about so that at least honorable members can also see that, you know, it's not just media on the national news, but also our work with community radio stations, Lesedi, Motsweding, you name all those issues. They've got a very high penetration. And maybe we should actually show, for example, the number of interviews we have with Lesedi or Motsweding or other radio stations to actually show that, you know, we are reaching out to a lot of people. But the challenge still stands there that we could do a lot more change. Then on the issue of the NPM, I'm trying to find my notes here. The NPM budget we have now currently is about 2.6 million, which we have got as a ring fence budget. But as I was saying, change in the last of the 3 years. So we'll be engaging with Treasury as well as government to see exactly how do we then fund the work of the NPM going forward. But we are working with other bodies like JICS, IPED, Military Ombudsman, and which other one again? To try and see how we can structure the NPM, because as you recall, Chair, the Commission has a monitoring role as well as a coordinating role. And when we submit our NPM second report very soon, again, members of the committee will see the kind of work which has been done by the Commission around the work of the NPM, which as far as we are concerned is definitely quite a successful work. I know we'll be having a conference in June this year, according to Commissioner Nissen, in Cape Town on the work of the NPM. And then, Chair, I also want to say that, you know, on the concerns which have been raised around monitoring, we are developing a monitoring system very soon. We are also have a budget to employ monitors in all the provinces who will help us to monitor issues of human rights. And we've prioritized three main issues, but the two ones are actually issues of education. Working together with Commissioner Gam, that we want to monitor what's happening around schools, especially, you know, in under basic education. And that two main areas which we are looking at, maybe three, is sanitation, water and sanitation infrastructure, as well as the issue of violence and bullying in schools. Right across. We have had meetings there with the South African Council of Educators to see how we can address it, because we are quite concerned about what is happening in that. So the plan should roll out very soon, and we should be able to report to the portfolio committee as to what we've been doing. And of course, the issue of health, again, we also want to focus on how the vaccination rollout will happen to make sure that, you know, also the concerns which have been raised about you know, how do we reach out to rural areas as far as vaccinations are concerned, but also how then do we, you know, improve our health infrastructure to make sure that, you know, we're able to survive the impact of COVID-19, because we're quite aware that COVID-19 is not only undermining our economy, it's also undermining human rights. At the same time, it's also highlighting the fault lines in our community, in our societies about, you know, inequalities in our countries, the divide between the rich and poor, but also the challenges around government in terms of providing services to our people, in terms of facilities and roads and stuff like that. So COVID-19, while it is a threat to everything else, but also creates an opportunity for all of us to really look at ourselves to say, as a country, as a government, what have we been doing around that? So our monitoring plan will basically help to look into these issues. And of course, the work around the NPM also, you know, we want to strengthen this so that we can also, you know, monitor as many police stations as possible, but also work with other bodies. So for example, we've been asked to assist the military ombudsman in some of their complaints. We also work, Chair, you know, with other chapter institutions. As I was saying, for us, the conference in March was quite a fascinating one, because I think for the first time, we basically invited all chapter institutions. The AG came and gave a talk on corruption and human rights, the Public Service Commission, Public Protector, and IPED, you know, and everybody was, including the Minister of Justice, just look into the issues of corruption. And again, those are issues which still have to be continued. And therefore, as I was saying then, our work around our desire to protect whistleblowers will also require us to engage with many other people who are working on these issues of whistleblower protection in order to increase the work we're doing, as well as our visibility. Chair, if I've left anything else, I'll ask my colleagues here to fill up the gaps in case I've missed anything. Sorry, my papers flew all over the table. So thank you, Chair.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for the responses. I think we have run out of time. But I think we've taken note of the responses you have given us. But indeed, on behalf of the committee, we must take this opportunity to congratulate you for the steps you have taken to cut to come up with innovative ways to try and cut theft to the extent it is possible. These are very difficult times. The national fiscus is struggling. The economy is struggling. So we are called upon as managers, as leaders, as public servants, as public office bearers to assist the country by trying to ensure that we try and work with what we have, and we come up with all the innovative ways to try and find resources to continue to implement the programs that we have presented to Parliament that we'll be in a position to implement. So we are really encouraged that you have been able even to forsake some of your comfort to ensure that you unlock resources so that programs can be funded that are meant to serve our people better. We hope that when you come back, you would have, as the chairperson has agreed that you will do, you would have dealt with the issue of the SMART principles in terms of your plans, so that we're in a position to monitor you better. And the implementation of the SMART principle also is one of the ways of ensuring that we have resources that meet the targets that we have set, and it also assists in ensuring that we deal with wasteful expenditure. So it's important that we must stick to it, and we must try and ensure that we work according to it. So thank you very much, Chair, and to your team of commissioners and senior leadership, senior managers of the South African Human Rights Commission. And we just an update. We have concluded in terms of the two commissioners, and we are hoping that by the time the House rises, which is going to be on the 4th of June, we should be in a position to have recommended to the House and to the President as to who becomes the Deputy Chair and the other full-time commissioner. That who is under control will be able to. I think we're working very hard to ensure that this term we finalize that particular process so that we can also, that will help the commission to be able to meet its targets and to lessen the workload on some of the commissioners and to the management of the committee, of the Human Rights Commission. Thank you very much, Chair. For your attendance and to the commissioners for keeping the fort during these difficult times, but we're doing whatever we can to ensure that you get your commissioners that can assist you very soon.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thanks for your leadership and guidance. We appreciate it. We appreciate the support once more of the Portfolio Committee and all its honorable.
Thank you very much. Members, let's have a 3 minutes break. And then we will invite the Deputy Minister, if he has joined, to lead us on the, we'll be dealing with the traditional courts. Thank you very much. Let's come back at 15 minutes past 11.
Thank you, Chair and Commissioners.
Thank you.
Everyone.
Good morning again, members, and to everybody in the virtual platform. The last time we discussed this matter of the traditional courts, we were failed by the information technology, so we could not hear. I think it was Ms. Mkize who was presenting on that day. So we decided to defer the discussion to a later date, which is today, so that we can continue with the presentation. I think she was responding to questions from Honorable Breitenbach on that day when when things fell apart and we could not really hear one ear and could not hear her on her side. So we thought that we should proceed from there. Ms. Mkize, are you on the virtual platform?
Greetings, Chairperson. It is Ms. Ngema, indeed.
Ms. Ngema, my apologies, Ms. Ngema. Sorry, Ms. Ngema. I also understand that the Deputy Minister is also part of the meeting. Welcome, Deputy Minister.
Thanks very much, Chairperson. Good morning to all the honourable members.
Thank you very much. Can I hand over to Ms. Ngema to proceed? I think we can see her clearly today. I don't think that there will be that sabotage again, so that you can be able to take this process forward.
Thank you so much, Chairperson. I'm trying to put up the presentation. Chairperson, the presentation is appearing on my side. I trust that it is also appearing on the side of the members. Basically, when we had connectivity problems, there were three questions that were posed, which I was ready to respond to. And the first question was, why has your opinion changed from what you last said on the constitutionality of the Traditional Courts Bill? The second question was, what is the meaning of opt-out principle? And the last question was, what happens if mediation process fails? So these are the three guiding questions that the presentation the members are seeing will be speaking to, Chairperson. I will first address the question about what changed. Chairperson, I think before we venture into the changes, if there were any in respect of the opinions, we need to appreciate that the opinion of 2018 that Legal Services presented, it was speaking to the bill that was introduced by the minister before Parliament. And that bill was very clear, expressing that for the litigants, the one that decides to put a dispute before the traditional court and the one that must come to respond, they both must make a consent or they both must be voluntarily willing to participate in the traditional court. And hence our opinion was asked based on that bill by the chairperson and the portfolio committee at the time to say what would be the position constitutionally if such expressions were removed in the bill. And that is where our first opinion was, and it was basically speaking, it concluded that removing the opt-out clause, as the bill was already constitutionally certified by the state law advisors as well as certified in Parliament, as was introduced and the taking confirming that it is constitutionally in order. That was the position we indicated, that what is being said by the bill as it stands is constitutional. And then the 2021 opinion, Chairperson, asked a question in light of the D version. And the D version was the bill that incorporated the changes by the portfolio committee and the changes by the select committee. So having looked in total of what the current bill that is before the committee today is stating, it was then the question of constitutional scrutiny on whether with or without the provisions that express whether the parties can opt in or opt out, will that still stand constitutional muster? And that is what our opinion was addressing, in fact, in both instances. So the only thing that changed was the content and the bill that we were speaking to when we speak about constitutional scrutiny. The B version was clearly expressive. The D version was not expressive. And we concluded in both opinions, especially the 2020, that with or without explicit opt-out, the bill will still pass constitutional muster. And why we have argued that position is because, Chairperson, if we look at the issues the bill addressed, there were three rights that were at interplay, and that is Section 34, which provides a right for a litigant to take any dispute to a court of choice or a tribunal or a forum. The second right is the right in Section 30, read with Section 31, which provides a choice to be involved and participate and enjoy any cultural life that you choose. So the question that we were addressing, and we have looked at the bills as they stand, is the question, what is the presumption and the intention of the legislature that it wanted to address? The first question was, the traditional courts bill, once it becomes enacted into law, it will be law of general application. That means it must apply to anybody without being specific that certain individuals it will apply to and other individuals it won't apply to. The second principle that the bill was considered under, did it consider the limits of the conflicting rights in light of Section 36? So what we did, we contrasted Section 36 as well as Section 34 and Section 30 and Section 31 to see if the bill as it stands, did the legislature consider what those provisions of the Constitution are indicating. And in light of having to look at that balancing effect, we have verified and we are of the view that the limitation of rights and the balancing of the rights that are conflicting, as I have indicated, and is accordingly and appropriately done in line with Section 36 of the Constitution. And because those rights are conflicting, the policy that came from the executive indicated a position which was accommodative of both the litigants. Whereas the position that came after the Assembly approved the B version, it only gave accordance to the right of the litigant that wants their dispute taken in the traditional court. So the one that must respond once the dispute is litigated must follow suit and the jurisdiction that is chosen by the one litigating as the first applicant. Secondly, Chairperson, when we looked at how these rights were conflicting and in terms of what the bill in the D version currently points out, we have identified that Section 36 was applied by both the Houses of Parliament through the Portfolio Committee and through the Select Committee, enabling them to conduct and exercise that deal with conflicting rights and ensuring that none of those rights then, using the balancing exercise, do not unreasonably and unjustifiably impair on the other. Therefore, Chairperson, what we found on the bill, as our opinion pointed out through the 2018 opinion as well as the 2021 opinion, was the fact that the balancing exercise conducted by both legislatures is very clear and is very lawful in the sense that the legal certainty that is required is coming out of the current provisions of the D version. It is clear that the one that applies Section 34 will be able to follow in light of Section 30, the cultural life that they have chosen if they are living a life that must be regulated following the traditional court should a dispute arise. Secondly, Chairperson, the proportionality test was conducted, if we look at the provisions of the bill, to show that the right that must be limited on the other party is justifiably limited. And it is clear how it was done. Therefore, Chairperson, the question on what then changed in our opinion, we've answered it by saying that through the application of the limitation test or the limitation of rights provision in terms of Section 36 and the proportionality test with the rationality that explains why such legislation must be enacted. That has been done through the bill. Secondly, Chairperson, we've also, from the question asked as to then, what is meant by opt-in and opt-out? We pointed out that in our opinion, it was clear that we were saying both litigants were able to exercise the opt-in or opt-out. But what this current bill, the D version, does is to give only the principle of opt-in. And therefore, Chairperson, we are still of the view that the B version, as it was amended, which at the time we gave our first opinion, there was no option. There was no draft version to say, this is what you are weighing. You are balancing and looking at the introduced version by the minister, or you are balancing the version that is now changed by the portfolio committee. We are then now saying today, and when we made the opinion in March, that was presented before the committee, that D version as it stands, and the B version that was then amended by the portfolio committee, all these three bills, in light of the principles that I have explained, that the law, once enacted, will be very clear. There shall be legal certainty, and it shall be law of general application. And lastly, if there is a limitation of rights, is such limitation justified? We are saying the current division as it is, considering all those principles and seeing that the legislature did take those principles into consideration, that division will definitely pass constitutional muster if it's taken to court and to assess the scrutiny of its constitutionality. Then, Chairperson, the second question that we had to address was to explain what is meant by the opt-in and where it derives from. We did indicate in our initial opinion, Chairperson, that the opt-in principle was sort of introduced into our law through the class actions that came in when we had the Bill of Rights entrenched in the Constitution, because there's still the autonomy of people to be individuals when they are collective action. That basically, that principle was indicating that if people still want to maintain their individual autonomy when there is collective action, you can make a choice whether you want to be part of the collective decision or you want to act on your own. Therefore, the principle of opting in if you want to be part of the collective, or opting out if you want to remain an individual and not be bound by the decisions or the impact out of the collective decision. But for purposes of the traditional courts bill, the issue or the principle of opt-in arise from the dictates of Section 30 and Section 31. If we read those constitutional provisions, they are very clear that when a person engages in the cultural life, it is their choice. It is again the rights that are at interplay with what the Constitution stipulates in Section 235. People can enjoy and participate in the right of their choice. But now, what is being argued for purposes of the traditional courts is the issue, when we are regulating the traditional courts, should people then be forced to follow the traditional courts? And I think what was clear from our first opinion is the fact that what we are arguing is the recognition of customary law. That customary law has already been recognized and is in lawful existence in terms of Chapter 12 of the Constitution. So when a person has decided to undergo a justice system that goes through traditional courts, that is a person's right following a recognized source of law and a recognized way of living. Therefore, it cannot be said that if such a person makes such a choice and makes a choice on the jurisdiction where their dispute will be tried, the other person can take away that, because that again will be taking away the right in terms of Section 34. That is where then Chairperson, the legal arguments for purposes of the traditional courts and the submissions that has been taken away were arising out of Section 30 and Section 31 of the Constitution. And then Chairperson, again, in light of that, we are still of the view that what the bill as it currently stands as a D version, it can actually pass constitutional muster and give a proper interplay and proper looking at balancing those three rights as they were conflicting. The last question, Chairperson, was on the process of mediation and what happens if mediation fails. The process of mediation, Chairperson, comes out of the provisions of the Constitution in Section 76 as well as Section 78. The bill, the traditional courts bill, was tagged as a Section 76 bill, and the minister introduces before the National Assembly. Then that means it followed the provisions that are outlined in Section 76.1 of the Constitution. The mediation process is also dictated or provided for in terms of that section. It occurs when the bill has gone through its legislative process, but because of whatever changes that have come through, as the current traditional courts bill now has a version that was passed by the National Assembly, which is a B version, and a version that was passed by the National Council of Provinces as a B version. The matter is now before the Portfolio Committee to look at the B version. Should the deliberations today on the D version not be supporting what the D version is providing, then that is where, if the matter goes to the Assembly with the report of the committee stating that we are either not supporting the changes from the NCOP or we are rejecting the D version, then the decision of the Assembly in terms of the rules of the National Assembly will then dictate whether the process needs to go to Section 78, which is the mediation process. And the mediation process, as outlined in Section 78, is a process which will involve both designated members. There will be 9 members from the Assembly, and there will be 9 members from the delegates of all the 9 provinces to sit as a mediation committee. The mediation committee will be provided with the bill as was introduced by the minister, which is called the Traditional Courts Bill 1, 2017, as well as the B version, which was changed by the Portfolio Committee, called the Traditional Courts Bill B of 2017, as well as this version, which is the D version, changed by the National Council of Provinces. Should the Mediation Committee not approve any of the three bills, because the joint rules, as I mentioned them, Chairperson, at joint rules number 185 to 189, they set out the process, what will happen. But should neither of all those bills be approved by the mediation committee, that is when mediation would have failed. And if it has failed, the joint rules are providing that the matter must then revert back to the House, and each House must deal with the matter in terms of their own rules. But specifically for the National Assembly, the relevant rules that will address this issue is National Assembly Rule 315, which also speaks to the three bills. And the Assembly will then have to make a decision and pass it with the voters outlined in Section 50, I think it's Section 58 of the Constitution, to say which bill must then pass now that we are having three bills, or there will be another fourth bill that will be provided by the Mediation Committee should it get to that. So there is no space. I think last time I indicated that the bill automatically lapses if the mediation fails. What must happen is that the matter must go back to each House, and it must be deliberated and a decision voted on and then taken. But if that does not happen, for an example, if the mediation committee does not meet within the 30 days, the minister, who is said to be the one in charge of the bill when it was introduced may again, in terms of National Assembly Rule 315, make a request to the Speaker to indicate whether it is the Assembly Bill that must be passed or what must be the position. So two instances may happen. The Houses will decide, and if they meet each other, that bill which they agree on will pass and will go to the President. But if out of all the four bills, none of the two Houses are meeting ad idem, then the Minister may make a request which of the bills must be voted on, and then it will be put on the order paper. And if the National Assembly passes that bill, then that will be the position the Traditional Courts Bill takes. But for now, it will all depend on what is the decision of the committee today. Does it pass the amendment of the National Council of Provinces through the D version, or does it reject the bill? Because I think one last thing I must add as I wind up, Chairperson, is that in terms of the rules of the Assembly, there are no amendments that can be proposed to the D version. And that is why we then have to follow through the process of mediation if there is no agreement on the D version. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Ms. Ngema. Can we remove this slide so that I can be able to see members? I have Honorable Verma, followed by Honorable Mola. Honorable Breitenbach. Honorable Vella. Honorable Nivot Trochen.
Thank you, Chair. Thanks. I'm still trying to read through the mediation process, but I'm not going to ask that question yet. I wanted to ask Ms. Pumulele, if one person wants their case heard in the traditional courts, but the opposing person, who's the respondent, doesn't want it in the traditional court, they want it in a normal court. What happens if the two of them oppose each other?
Thank you very much. Honorable Mola.
Thank you very much, Chair. Our participants welcome the presentation of the traditional court bill. Chair, I have a comment and a proposal to the committee. I've got the presentation in detail, and Ms. Ngema has done justice in terms of outlining what were the issues, how did they go about in trying to ratify some defects and all that and all. The institution of traditional leadership is too complex. It's too complex on the basis that at some point it differs from one tribe to the other, it differs from one community to the other, it differs from one village to the other or one place to the other. I want us to be meticulous when we're dealing with this particular bill, so that we curb the risk that it carries. As the explanation goes on, you see, you listen, there are some risks here and there. We know, Chair, with the history of statutes in Parliament that have been challenged to a number of courts. Some of them were declared null and void. So I want to plead to the committee chair to be very meticulous when we're dealing with this matter. The first point I want to raise, I did not hear Ms. Ngema saying, in all these things of mediation, opt-out, opt-in, what was the view or the submission of the House of Traditional Leaders in the opt-in, opt-out mediation issue? The second chair will go to the committee, to yourself and the entire members of the committee, to propose that, let us maybe for the last time take the bill as it is presented and solicit the services of a senior counsel in the legal unit of parliament to take us through again with the legal risks, the strengths and the weaknesses of this bill. How do we go about making sure that we don't make legal defects in terms of going forward approving it? So I would like to make that proposal to the committee that we must solicit services of the senior legal counsel in this matter for the last time. Maybe. I've heard that there was one in 2018, there was one in 2019. Can you have the last one? But one meticulous in dealing with this matter. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mola, Honorable Glenis Breitenbach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning to everybody, and thank you for the expanded input on the legal opinion. Again, I've listened very, very carefully to your additions and your explanation, and I say this with the greatest of professional respect to you. I fundamentally disagree with your departure point. I cannot reconcile myself to a bill that disallows vulnerable members of the population who are not lawyers, who do not have easy access to lawyers, who already struggle with access to justice in the mainstream courts, for want of a better expression, and not to denigrate traditional courts at all. I have the greatest, as a lawyer, the greatest respect for customary law and traditional courts. But people already struggle with access to justice. And this bill, with a stroke of a pen, is going to subject millions of people, but more particularly women, to a system that they do not want to be part of necessarily, that they do not necessarily view as fair. So a system that is, again, with the greatest of respect, deeply patriarchal. And I cannot reconcile myself to a bill that with a stroke of a pen subjects those members of the population to a system that they do not want to be part of, and they have no choice. The principal litigator wants to litigate in a traditional court, so be it. Then the second litigator, the person who's dragged along to court, has no choices. They have to go through the entire process, and I went through this the last time, you haven't answered it. They have to go through the entire process, then when that's over, they have to approach a court, an ordinary court, to have it set aside. How will they get there? Who will advise them? Who will pay for it? It's going to create such an untold mess. And I say that again with the greatest of respect. I see nothing but trouble. I see nothing but unfairness and trouble. And I cannot reconcile myself to it. So without an explicit, and it doesn't matter how many times the Honourable Deputy Minister says that it's implicit, without an explicit opt-out clause, I believe this bill is unconstitutional. I believe it entrenches inequality. And I cannot support it. I must allow myself to the suggestion of the Honourable Mola, and this is again no disrespect to yourself, that perhaps we should seek a second opinion from an outside third party, Silk, who is not at all invested or involved in this matter, who can bring us an objective view. But as the law stands, I cannot support it, and I cannot advise my party to support it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairler. Masako Chairler.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you also to the presenter. Good morning, members. Chairperson, I only have one question from Ms. Ngema. The manner in which, because this bill, in honesty, most of the people that are going to benefit from are our people from the rural areas. Even if, yes, we do benefit from the urban areas, but most of the people who really would appreciate to have such a bill are the people, like I said already. So I just want to find out from Ms. Ngema, the manner in which it has been presented with all those opt-out and opt-in, was it presented to the traditional leaders? And I'm not sure, because remember, some of us we are just joining the committee, and we hear that there we have been the first virgin, second virgin, and this one too. So I just want to find out the views, if ever there were views in line with what now it is really holding us. What was their views, Chair? Only that one. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Deputy Minister.
Thanks very much, Chair. Look, I just wanted to make a few comments. And let me just start with what Honorable Breitenbach said. This bill is going to subject millions of people to an unjust system or whatever. I can't remember the exact wording, sorry. This bill is not creating traditional courts. Those traditional courts are already there. This bill is trying to regulate those courts to make them consistent with the Constitution. Yes, the bill that was introduced had an opt-out clause. It came from a reference group of traditional leaders and civil society people. As I've said before, the idea was the aim was a bill that people could live with, not one that everybody supported. And we got that, a bill that people could live with, but probably nobody was particularly keen on it. But the problem largely is that we have a dual system in our country. Because of our history, the colonialists, the Boers didn't take all the land. Some land was left, which remained in what were called reserves, which were under traditional leaders and customary law. And those areas were then put into the homelands, into the Bantustans. But this dual system is recognized in the Constitution, and I think it's chapter 10, and that's the reality. It's there, and there are traditional courts that are there. Sorry, not that chapter 10, I think it's chapter 12. Chapter 12. Those courts are there, they're functioning. So I know from many of the people, particularly from civil society, I think there was a article somebody sent me sort of in memory of the late Ms. Suzanne Ngubane, which I thought summed it up, and she actually had attended some of the meetings of the reference group. But the article, it's by somebody called Richard Baber, spoke about the fact that she had campaigned with her rural women's movement, mobilizing rural women against these harmful pieces of legislation. They organized marches and sent people to parliament. While the traditional Khoisan Leadership Act was passed, the traditional courts bill was previously defeated, although devastatingly, it has been revived. And I think that for me sums up the issue. You know, some people see it as devastating that we have a bill on traditional courts.
But, you know, our options are either we've got to change the constitution, abolish traditional leadership, outlaw traditional courts, or we've got to regulate them. And I think they do provide mechanisms for people to get disputes resolved. I think on the issue of whether it's constitutional or not, and with due respect to Honourable Nwola, that will be for the Constitutional Court to decide. Ms. Ngema is quite adamant it is constitutional. I would have had a more conservative approach would be that it may be, it may not be. We hope it's constitutional, but ultimately the Constitutional Court will decide. And we've seen even, you know, the Supreme Court of Appeal being overruled by the Constitutional Court on particular issues. The issue also, anyway, of constitutionality, I mean, Parliament has twice said this bill is constitutional when it was passed in the last term by the previous National Assembly, and then this term by the National Council of Provinces. So the issue basically is, okay, even if it isn't constitutional, can the NA at this stage do anything about it? Because it's been said that it's the limitation for the National Assembly is to look at the NCOP amendments, which, you know, quite frankly, are pretty basic standard. There's nothing particularly substantial in them. Changing reference to the Traditional Leadership and Governance Framework Act to applicable legislation, some typos, those kinds of things. Changing the name of the bill to, from 2019 to 2020. Well, we're now on 2021. And by the way, again, some of the civil society, well, it's one particular organization that if you look at all the media reports or media articles written that is spearheading its opposition to the bill. And I think they should actually come out and say, do you support traditional leadership or not? But anyway, they had the cheek, I think, to say that this bill was being rushed. It's not being rushed. But anyway, the point I'm making, Chair, is that even if it is constitutional, can the National Assembly consider any further amendments? The President, has it not shifted to the President, who has the power to refer a bill back to Parliament if he believes it may not be constitutional? Because my concern about further opinions is you may get some that say yes, you may get some that say no. Ultimately, it's the Constitutional Court that will decide. So I just sort of want to raise that as a concern. I noticed that Honourable Breitenbach in the previous meeting had raised concerns over the issues of gender. Just to say in the reference group with some pretty prominent feminists, there was no disagreement on the clauses relating to the participation of women. But I think my key concern is that in the first meeting that the previous minister and I had with both civil society and traditional leaders. Civil society, including, I remember, Ms. Alinka Klaassen from LARC, who are very active on this matter, had said that the bill was urgently needed. And unfortunately, we discovered later that although one thing was being said, there were other attempts to undermine the process to try and come up with a bill. The concern is if it's not finalized, those courts continue unregulated. So, Chair, I just wanted to raise those points. And then maybe the other issue is that when the first version, I think that's the B version, was passed in the National Assembly, the then Minister of Cooperative Governance, who was Dr. Zwelium Mkhize, it was the last administration, did have consultations with traditional leaders, I think the National House, and they accepted the bill. It then obviously had to go to when in particular. That was the B version, which is substantially what you have now, just with the NCOP amendments. I'm not sure if Ms. Ngema was aware of that, but from the executive side, I'm aware of that. But anyway, so the point I'm making basically is concern that this bill has been around for a long time. It's been debated. Yes, even members of, and again, to correct something, I saw that somebody from LARC had claimed I'd said, the reference group, not all the reference group members are happy with this version of the bill. They wanted the opt-out clause in, and that was in the bill that was introduced. Parliament made not just, or the portfolio committee didn't just take it out, it also, though, changed things to allow for appeals to the magistrates' court. So it wasn't a question of just taking that out and putting it back in. But anyway, so yes, it's controversial, but we can debate for another. We've been debating this bill for 20 years, I think. We can debate it for another 20 years, and all the while the courts continue when I think it's better if they were regulated. And on the constitutionality issue, I would say, can the National Assembly make amendments if they have concerns over constitutionality, or is that issue now with the President if the bill is passed, who can just refer it back if it is deemed to be, or if it's concerned that it might be unconstitutional? Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much. Over to you, Ms. Ngema, to answer the questions that were asked to you.
Thank you so much, Chairperson, and thank you to the Deputy Minister and to the questions that have been posed. Chairperson, I think on my side, it's mostly two questions that I need to tackle. Firstly, I think it will be the last one that asks whether the National House of Traditional Leaders did make an input in terms of the tagging processes and the public hearings and what took place when the bill was before the National Assembly. The referral in terms of Section 18 of the Traditional Leadership Framework Act was done because this is a Section 76 bill and it also relates to issues of customary law and customs. Therefore, Chairperson, the National House of Traditional Leaders' input was sourced officially and it was part of the presentations as well when it took place earlier on. In terms of the other question, which was first as to what happens where the opposing litigants do not find one another in terms of confirming the jurisdiction, the Deputy Minister did touch on that. The process as it appears on the bill, Chairperson, it allows that the process must go through right to the end with the party that is not keen to be going through the process, but then there's been an added provision that takes the case to review where the party was not happy in the processes. As I said, Chairperson, those are the two questions. In terms of the input, the Secretariat Office can present the written submission that was sourced from the National House of Traditional Leaders. Chairperson, thank you.
No, thank you very much. Let me start by saying, Ms. Ngema, I think
I'm sorry, Chair. My computer does not have a hand raise facility. My name is Teresa Ross from the Department of Justice. On the question that was raised by Honorable Velma, that Ms. Ngema has just spoken to add to that, if a party, in terms of the bill, if a party does not, you know, like she says, they don't find themselves in terms of appearing before a traditional court, then a clerk of the traditional court will then make a determination to that effect. To the effect that the other party is not willing to appear before the court. And then thereafter, the matter, the clerk of the court will then, that is in terms of the bill, will then refer the matter to the Justice of the Peace, who will then negotiate or mediate with the party who is not willing to participate in the process. But that is just as far as it takes the matter, because then the Justice of the Peace will then perform his or her functions in terms of the in line with the Justice of the Peace and Commissioner of Oaths Act. Thank you, Chair.
Chair, can I just add on that?
Proceed, dear.
As I mean, following on this Ross should have gone a bit further. You know, as she said, it's up to if the person doesn't appear, then it goes to the Justice of the Peace, who must go and try and speak to the party who doesn't want to appear, and it's clause 44B 2. Then effectively, if the party against whom the summons was issued is the person who didn't comply, then the Justice of the Peace can request the traditional court to have the matter transferred to the magistrates' court having jurisdiction. But to to Honourable Breitenbach, you know, I think currently, I mean, things differ from court to court, but I think currently in many places people are forced to participate. This, as far as I would see it, is that that isn't forcing. And then otherwise, remember that the bill does have the broad principles the voluntary nature of customary law. So there are those principles throughout the bill as well. But I just sort of wanted to raise that. So there isn't actually a provision, there's no provision in the bill that you have to attend. And if there's any penalties if you don't, what's in the bill is provisions that if you don't, it can be referred to the magistrate's court. Thanks, Jay.
Thank you very much, TM, and to Ms. Ross. Let me take this opportunity to thank Ms. Ngema for diligently applying herself to the task that was given to her. I think it's important that as the House, whether ultimately we can be found to have the bill might be found to be constitutional or unconstitutional, but what is important for us as Parliament or as the National Assembly is that at the time the bill is passed by us, we must be convinced ourselves beyond doubt that the bill is constitutional. And we should take every step to ensure that we are convinced as the relevant House that the bill that we have passed is constitutional. The President is not the member of the House. If the bill reaches the desk of the President for assent, and the President refers that bill back, it's part of the constitutional dispensation that allows for that. But it would be bad if we transmit the bill as Parliament to the President when ourselves we are not really sure. It's important that we must have satisfied ourselves that at the time the bill is transmitted to the President for assent, we have done our work diligently and we believe in the product that you are sending to the President. So I think there is a proposal that is before us that was seconded by members of the committee that notwithstanding the fact that Ms. Ngema has diligently applied herself. The problem is not with her product. The problem is that there's still uncertainty amongst us as to whether the bill is constitutional. we are of the view that in the meantime, let's get an outside senior counsel to just to take the doubt in our mind as to the constitutionality of the bill. It's not a matter of being right or wrong. As the Deputy Minister has already indicated that even amongst the courts, it will be taken to the High Court, to the Supreme Court of Appeal, then to the Constitutional Court. But what is important is that at the time we conclude the bill, we must be convinced that we have done everything possible to ensure that we pass something we believe in and we believe in its constitutionality. Therefore, there is no objection from the members of the portfolio committee that the bill be sent for an outside senior counsel, either to corroborate what Ms. Ngema has said or to point us to, so that we can be able to consider everything else that might come, so that we would be convinced that the bill that we would have passed is indeed constitutional. Is that in order, members?
It is, Mr. Chair. May I say something?
Honorable Pettenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to correct something the Deputy Minister said, and I'm sure he didn't mean it that way, but he said, I said the traditional court system is unjust. I never said so. I don't for one moment suggest that it's an unjust system. I never did. So I just want that to be quite clear. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Can I just come back? I didn't intend to say that. I accept that Honourable Breitenbach had raised concerns around possible injustices, and that was the issue I was addressing. So no dispute I have with her.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Deputy Minister. Thank you for clarifying that. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Ms. Ngema, for the hard work and for you applying yourself thoroughly into what we have asked you to do. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Chairperson and the members. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Members, we have a bit of a challenge. We still have we need to deal with the report of correctional services and the report of the salaries for both magistrates, judges, and Chapter 9 institutions, the adoption of the minutes. Those are issues that are still outstanding. I propose the following: that we deal with the substance of the program, in fact, of the agenda. And then when it comes to voting, I will appeal to all parties to ensure that their members are present or their alternate members are present in case their main members are not present, so that we have the required quorum to vote. To approve the budgets. We will deal with the budget for correctional services, the Office of the Chief Justice, and we will vote for the budget of Justice, Department of Justice next week, because we have just received the briefing on South African Human Rights Commission, so they would need to also include that. So by next week, we will be ready to vote on the budget on the Department of Justice. So today, it will be Office of the Chief Justice and the Department of Correctional Services that will be voting on. So can we start generally dealing with the content? And then when it comes to voting during that process, can the leaders of parties that are present ensure that their members are present too, so that we do have the quorum to pass the all the issues that we need to vote on, including the salaries. Is that acceptable, members?
Yes, Chair.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, can I just ask you to confirm we want to deal with those today?
Yes.
I'll try. Thank you.
Yes, because for instance, in terms of the parliamentary program, we need to vote on Tuesday to debate on Tuesday the office of the Chief Justice, and which means by today we should have voted on that budget vote, whether it is approved so that it can go to the House or not.
Chair, can I be excused?
Okay. I was under the impression that you would want to lead the discussion for the salaries. Oh, no, you did that. Sorry, Tim. My apologies. I know that I will pay for it for the next 6 years. My apologies.
Okay, thanks, Jenna. I can stay if there's any further questions. If you're willing to do, if it's possible to do the salaries first, but just for the, it's obviously not appropriate for me to be making inputs into the committee reports.
Yes. No, thank you very much. No, you are excused, Deputy Minister.
Thanks, Chair. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you very much. Can we start with the dealing generally with the content, and before we go to voting, I see the hands. Honourable Breitenbach and Honourable Nivo Tachan.
Sorry, it's an old hand.
Okay, thank you very much. Honourable Nivo Tachan.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to ask, do we have enough quorum to vote now?
I just addressed that issue, Honourable Neibout, that we are going to deal with the content for now, and I've asked party leaders in the committee to ensure that their members are present, and so they can start calling their members, so that by the time we come to the voting, we should have the quorum. Is that in order, Honourable Nivo Tachan? You are muted.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Can we start with Correctional Services? Members, can we have a 5 minutes break? So that we can respond to nature, and then we'll start with correctional services.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for that.
Thank you.